This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. When a commercial rocket blew up seconds after it left its launch pad in Virginia last week, it didn't look good. But hey, stuff happens with space travel. 3 days later, Virgin Galactic's experimental tourism spacecraft broke apart over the Mojave Desert. Commercial space exploration is here to stay, but with those two accidents have drawn new attention and maybe new scrutiny. This hour on Point, commercial space, where it is headed. You can join us on air or online. Did last week's two space accidents make you sit up and wonder? Do you even understand NASA's role in space exploration these days? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Los Angeles is Andy Pastor, senior special writer for the Wall Street Journal, covering aviation, aerospace, and air safety. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So it's been a hard week or so after these two separate accidents, one in Virginia, an Orbital Sciences rocket carrying a supply vessel to the International Space Station, and the other a Virgin Galactic space plane exploding during a test flight over the Mojave Desert. Tell us the latest. Give us the latest on these investigations.
So they're separate investigations, of course, and we have to be sure to make to put the categories into sort of separate ways.
Yes.
First of all, the Orbital Sciences rocket, I think, is going to be a short-term, relatively short-term problem. NASA is committed to using private rockets to take cargo and astronauts to the International Space Station. The industry is committed. It spent a bunch of money. Orbital Sciences and Space Exploration Technologies Corp, or SpaceX as it's known, have rockets and capsules, and those rockets and capsules have proven to be successful in some previous flights. And so I think that's a temporary glitch. I think it looks bad. It'll cost some money. It'll delay some things. I think the Virgin Galactic accident is much more serious, both in terms of public perceptions and in terms of substance. A big brand, much touted, led by a brash entrepreneur, but more significantly, I think it will produce the first real federal scrutiny of commercial space efforts. The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating, as your listeners have probably heard. A co-pilot prematurely unlocked the tail surface, which then moved on its own as it shouldn't have, causing the spacecraft to disintegrate. But I think the significant point is that the National Transportation Safety Board will be looking at much more than just what that co-pilot did and what that single spacecraft, what happened to that single spacecraft. There will be a major scrub, basically, of the way that Sir Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic have conducted the business.
Safety,
all sorts of things.
Yeah, Richard Branson, of course, the face of that venture. Here he is at a press conference on Saturday. Richard Branson saying that Virgin Galactic will not push on blindly into the space tourism business.
We've always known that commercial space travel is an incredibly hard project. We've been undertaking a comprehensive testing program for many years, and safety has always been our number one priority. This is the biggest test program ever carried out in commercial aviation history, precisely to ensure that this never happens to the public.
So, Andy, then, this is the first real federal scrutiny. You hear Richard Branson there. You know, talk about how big of a blow this is for the private sector, for commercial space industry. Richard Branson's been out there in the front of it.
Well, I think it's significant. The National Transportation Safety Board will look at all sorts of things, and it'll really come up with, I think, some criticisms and some recommendations. And I think the fallout from all of this is that the scope and scale and speed with which this industry will develop will be significantly slowed down. For some perspective, just a few years ago, proponents of Virgin Galactic talked about having as many as 50,000 people going up to space per year by the end of this decade. Mm-hmm. Now, admittedly, that was a very ambitious goal. Realistically, we're looking at perhaps the first passenger going up by the middle of this decade, and it's not at all clear how quickly this industry will grow. There is a passionate core group of space aficionados who are willing to pay big bucks to go up to a suborbital on a suborbital flight to see the Earth from near space. But how large that group is and whether they'll really stick with it once they see that this is really pretty dangerous stuff remains unclear. And the last point I'd like to make is that the hope of the commercial space industry was that if they had a fatal accident, and everybody knew they would have one, it was inevitable, that it would happen after they developed enough public confidence and had enough successful flights under their belt, that they could say, look, we've done okay, mistakes happen, we're going to go forward. Unfortunately, this accident, of course, happened at the very beginning before anybody has gone up.
Here's Christopher Hart at a press conference on Sunday. He's the acting chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board. He said that the feathering devices, a kind of supersonic air brake on Spaceship Two, seem to have malfunctioned or been deployed too early. But he made it clear he still has no firm proof that's what actually happened, that's what actually caused the crash, and that no matter what, a thorough investigation is coming in the year ahead.
I want to emphasize that we have not determined the cause. I am not stating that this is the cause of this mishap. We have months and months of investigation to determine what the cause was. We'll be looking at training issues. We'll be looking at, was there pressure to continue testing? We'll be looking at safety culture. We'll be looking at the design, the procedure. We've got many, many issues to look into much more extensively before we can determine the cause.
So, Andy, obviously we're in new territory here. I mean, I read a comment from our Facebook page. Thomas says, I'd love to see today's media covering the beginning of the airplane. Would be hilarious to see the overreaction to small test accidents on the way to a humanity-changing invention. A first few of the kind of test issues that we have here. Everybody goes up in arms. Does everybody forget why it is that we have flight tests to begin with? I mean, are these kinds of mishaps expected, Andy, as we enter this new phase of space travel and space exploration?
Yes, I think they are. And Thomas is right that there were many accidents in the beginning of commercial aviation. The two things, though, that sort of point in the other direction is that Sir Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic have portrayed this in a much different way. The company was originally supposed to start taking passengers up in 2007 or 2008. And, of course, it's been much delayed because they've had significant technical issues with the engines, clearly now with the design of the space plane, because what happened should not have happened. Even if the co-pilot made a mistake, there should have been safeguards to prevent an occurrence such as the one that occurred. So, therefore, I think it's true, accidents happen in test flights, and that's expected. But it has been portrayed, certainly by some, this industry, as, well, it's just like, you know, it'll be just like getting on a regular aircraft down the road, and we'll have 10 flights a day, and it'll be incredibly plush in the cabin, and this will be a fantastic thing. And I don't think that the public has accurately gotten the perception that this is incredibly difficult, and the technical challenges really at this point, I would say, are still ahead of them. Many of the technical challenges are still ahead of them. And what Christopher Hart didn't say is, yes, they haven't pinpointed a cause, but it's pretty clear that the co-pilots unlocking the system and the movement of the tail boom led directly to the disintegration of the aircraft. They won't say that yet, but there's no indication that anything else went wrong on that spacecraft.
Well, Andy Pastor is senior special writer for The Wall Street Journal, covering aviation, aerospace, and air safety. He joined me from Los Angeles. Andy, thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Joining me now from Tampa is Jason Ryan, editor and founder of the online space journal Space Flight Insider. He's covered more than 60 launches and has flown with the crew of the STS-135 as they practiced landing Space Shuttle Atlantis. Jason, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So you heard Andy there. I mean, talk to us about the many, many different commercial ventures that are out there today. We hear about Richard Branson. He's the face of this big one. But talk to us about the myriad of people that are trying this out.
Well, Jane, that's a good point that you raise. It is a myriad of people. We tend to, especially within the news industry, to try to shoehorn things into a a certain word. Their new space, their private space, their commercial space. But what we seem to forget is that while Orbital and SpaceX are focused almost predominantly on NASA, you got folks like Virgin Galactic who are doing the space tourism industry. And then you have others that are working on just a certain type of propulsion system. Another group is trying to land a rover on the moon, or another type is trying to develop printers that will, 3D printers, which will help produce components in space. So I think it's important that the public knows that the term commercial space is a very, very vast subject, and that they not tend to – I mean, even in the case of this accident, you had two totally different entities. You had one that was a rocket that's only flown missions to the ISS for NASA, and the other one was a commercial venture to have tourists do hops into suborbit for a few seconds – for a few minutes of zero gravity. So there's a plethora of companies that are out there that do a wide range of things that are trying to open the space frontier.
Plethora is right. I'm looking at Wikipedia here. Gosh, three different pages of active companies in this new space organizational area. Here's Moon Express, Rocket Lab, Skybox Imaging, Zero Gravity Corporation, just to name a few on three pages here. I mean, what are the financials here? How much money is being spent in private space innovation?
Well, Jane, there's billions being spent on the privatization of space. And to be honest, it's a good thing that it's happening, because essentially the public just sees NASA. And they think it's even I think it was on either Fox News or CNN when the Antares blew. They said a NASA rocket explodes. Well, that's not true. It was an Orbital Sciences Corporation rocket that explodes. Technically speaking, NASA doesn't own either the launch vehicle or the space Cygnus spacecraft that flew on top of it. So there's really Moon Express is another one. They're working with NASA. I was over at Kennedy yesterday, and they're partnering with NASA through an unfunded Space Act agreement to learn about new technologies and to learn from NASA's experience. So there's just a, you know, one size does not fit all.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the future of commercial, private space travel this hour, and you can join the conversation. Do you have a clear picture of just how much the private sector is moving into space? Is this the new Wild West, and do we need a sheriff to bring a little law and order to the final frontier? Richard Branson said in an interview on CNN over the weekend that test pilots take great risks in these ventures, but it's all for a good cause.
Test pilots would say that because they know the risk they're taking, that they know the importance of what they're doing. We know the importance of what we're doing. If test pilots hadn't taken risks, we wouldn't have had the 747. Two of the comets blew up in the early days of airline travel, and now airline travel is as safe as anything. We've got to go through the difficult testing stage of creating a space line in order to make it safe for travelers who want to travel on that space line in the years ahead.
So my guest this hour, Jason Ryan, editor and founder of the online space journal Space Flight Insider. And joining me now from Washington is Marco Caceres. He's senior space analyst and director of space studies for the aerospace consulting firm Teal Group. They do reports and proprietary studies for NASA and big aerospace giants like Boeing, but do not have clients among the new crop of space entrepreneurs like Virgin Galactic or Orbital Sciences. Marco, great to have you with us.
Hi, Jane.
So in light of these recent accidents, I'm curious about test flights. Can you talk to us about that for a minute? What does last week's accident suggest to you about the need for more testing?
Well, keep in mind, this program has launched approximately 54 flights. But of those 54 flights, only four of those were powered flights. In other words, the engine was turned on and the vehicle, Space Plane 2, actually flew. The other 50 were essentially where the space plane attached to the carrier aircraft, the White Knight 2, took off together, and then it when they reached a certain altitude, the space plane was dropped and it glided down to Earth and landed like a plane. And so there are certainly huge benefits to doing that over and over again. But at some point, you really do need to get into powered test flights, test flying much more regularly. And I think from hearing Mr. Branson's comments that that's what they were planning to do over the next year before proceeding to the operational phase where they would start launching passengers.
So only 4 powered test flights out of 54 flights. Is this more of a scale problem then? I mean, even billionaires like Richard Branson and the rest don't have the money to do the kind of testing that's needed to work out some of these kinks?
Well, that may be part of it, but the fact is that they've had problems with the engine, with the fuel mix. They had an explosion, I believe, with the engine back in 2007 on the ground, and they've been working very, very hard to work out the kinks. And they had another problem, I believe, with the powered flight in January of this year. And so they have not been rushing, contrary to what some people like to think. They've not been rushing too quickly through this. They've kept the safety of the test pilots uppermost in their mind, and that's probably why they haven't flown more in terms of powered flights.
Mm. I made a holler in here. Tim is in Waterville, Maine. Hi, Tim. Thanks for calling. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Rocket science is hard, and I think it would be inappropriate to judge the next 5, 20, 50 years of spaceflight for the public to judge the outcome of what's going to happen based on these two events. We've all seen this, the videos of our first attempts at airplanes with the funny music and the wings falling off and the planes not getting off the ground. And That's what these two accidents are, and there'll be more accidents to come, but eventually we'll make it to the stars, and this will just be a footnote.
Hmm. Tim, thank you. Jason Ryan, speak to that. I hear that a lot. We heard from our Facebook listener Thomas earlier. I mean, we have a lot of unfair judgments about these incidents.
I think there really is. We live in the 24-hour news cycle, and what ends up happening is, folks don't generally hear a lot about space. The space program has kind of left the public behind. I mean, the public is just not really – that's not really what they focus in on. Sadly, it seems almost like they focus a bit more on Duck Dynasty or Honey Boo Boo. And so, they tend to overlook just how difficult it is to get into space. And these private companies are doing what only NASA, China, and Russia – and a very, very nations have actually attempted before. So the thing that I think the public most needs to take away from this is at least in terms of NASA, and I'm going to focus a bit on that for a second, is this is how we ought to do it. I mean, NASA should serve as a pathfinder. They take us to orbit, and then the commercial companies go behind that. They go to the moon, and then once they've established how that works out, then they hand the day-to-day operations of lunar exploration, if you will, or exploitation, if you will, to the private companies. And then they go on and on and on. But every step of the way after they're finished, they hand it over to the private sector. I mean, NASA doesn't – I also think it's very important to note that NASA doesn't build rockets. They don't build spacecraft. Lockheed Martin builds rockets and spacecraft. Mm. Boeing builds rockets and spacecraft. And so what tends to get into the public's mind is that when this goes wrong, it's NASA's fault. And it's not. There is no such thing. We have this term we use, which is called new space or private or commercial. And again, it's a shorthand. What we really have is another set of contractors, a newer set of contractors. Back in the old days, it was Boeing and Lockheed Martin. Well, now it's Orbital and SpaceX and some others. And I think that what we need to kind of get away from is putting these catchphrases on things to make them a little more easier to understand. What we really have going on is just a new set of contractors that are learning the rules, and there's going to be these issues that crop up when they need to figure out what's wrong, dust themselves off with humility, and then move on.
Well, I think that's an important point there with humility. Marco Caceres, talk a little bit about some of the cultural issues with these new space innovators. Is it fair to say that there is some, if not a lot, of hubris attached here?
It's fair. I think whenever you have new players like Mr. Musk, Elon Musk, and Mr. Branson, and Jeff Bezos of Amazon, these are very successful business people. They've made a lot of money, and they have tremendous vision. And they've drawn a lot of attention to their ventures, and they've brought in a lot of private capital to their ventures. And so as an analyst that's been tracking this industry for over a quarter century, I think that's a good thing. I think that that is what brings attention to this industry, to the commercial space industry, to the space industry in general. NASA has been trying to fuel the commercialization of space since the 1980s, and they have not been particularly successful because that's not really NASA's mandate. Mandate is mainly to is science, it's exploration. And when they're tasked to try to find ways to create excitement within the public, to recreate the excitement that they that we had back in the days of Apollo, they're really out of their really they're out of their atmosphere, let's say, because that's just not that's not what they do. And so I think the infusion of new energy, new personalities like Branson and Musk and Bezos is actually quite a good thing, even if it comes with some brashness and what some people may interpret as arrogance.
SpaceX is the first company to successfully fly its own craft to the International Space Station and back. And last summer, its CEO Elon Musk took a jab at Virgin Galactic's founder Richard Branson, saying he's a nice guy, but, quote, technology is not his whack, end quote. Branson conceded the point but said he's building his space tourism business on the talents of the people he's hired.
I would not be able to change a sparking plug, and I would not be able to fly a spaceship or build a build a rocket or whatever. But what I am good at doing is finding brilliant people and surrounding myself with brilliant people.
So you've got these so-called thrillionaires out there, I think that's what the New York Times called them, who've jumped into this commercial space industry. Jeff Bezos set up Blue Origin. Elon Musk founded SpaceX. He wants to go to Mars one day. I've interviewed Richard Branson a couple of times, and even 10 or 15 years ago, he was talking about commercial space ventures. Obviously, these are very confident and wealthy people, but Jason Ryan, are they the right kind of people? Besides money, do they have the right stuff for this new age of space?
Well, back in the day, Elon Musk was interviewed, I want to say on 60 Minutes, I may be mistaken, and he was asked, well, what qualifies you to be a rocket designer? And if memory serves, his comment was something, well, I read a lot. Well, I'm paraphrasing there, but I mean, in the end, yeah, they do have what they need, what is needed. And in the end, it's money, because space isn't cheap. And the one thing that I think we all need to get out of the mindset of is, and I wrote an article about this a while back, is the word of the use, routine. Spaceflight in its current configuration will never be routine. Until we, as long as we're using chemical-based rockets and the spacecraft that ride on them, it's not going to be routine. So we need to get away from that mindset, and we need people that are willing to put their quote-unquote skin in the game and to be willing to take the hard knocks, but again, with humility, and to say, one of the things that I've noticed is new space, quote unquote, going back to that catchphrase, yeah, will say, well, we can do anything NASA can do, but better, until they have an accident. And then it's, well, you know, you need to give us more time. You need to be more understanding and patient. We are new after all. And my thought on that is, well, that's great. I would say you need to pick one of those two and stick by it. And if it was my recommendation, it would be the second one. You need to do so with a little bit of humility. But yeah, they need, and I don't know that this animal exists, they need humble billionaires. And if they can find those, and those
that
can
that
do so
exist,
patient.
Humble billionaire. Yeah. Let's go to a caller, David in Winchester, Tennessee. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My thought is that these two recent accidents are a cautionary tale about government cutbacks in funding for NASA research. When we put this tough scientific mission into commercial hands, which may be the right and only thing to do, we run the risk of trying to generate profits for venture capitalists and stockholders and using cheap Russian jet engine or rocket engines from 1960 is not the way to have successful technical missions. There are parallels in the healthcare industry now that are probably less dramatic with hospitals, but you know, you just can't take tough research and the engineering excellence that we had in the 60s and run it like a company, a corporation necessarily, and expect flawless and wonderful outcomes.
David, thank you very much for your call. Let me put some sound in here. Last week, after the failed launch of a rocket intended to deliver supplies to the International Space Station for NASA, Frank Culbertson, executive vice president of the spaceflight company Orbital Sciences, said that their rocket used a refurbished Russian engine built back in the 1960s.
Basically, this was an engine that was designed to carry cosmonauts to the moon. A number of them were bought by Aerojet several years ago to be refurbished and Americanized and provided to American industry. It's an extensively tested engine. It is very robust and rugged, and it goes through extensive testing by a team at Stennis Space Center before it's ever installed on the rocket and used as the power plant.
Marco Caceres, I mean, to David's point, the caller David, and then to this sound here, I mean, using Russian engines built back in the 1960s, does that account for cutting corners? I mean, is that playing into David's point, his question?
It's certainly possible. I think, look, these engines were built back in the 1960s, the late 1960s, I believe, by a Russian company, and then they were bought by an American company called Aerojet. Now it's Aerojet Rocketdyne, and I think they paid $1 million per engine, which is a bargain. And then they went through a process of refurbishing them, doing a lot of rewelding, adding new fuel lines and some new electronics. And so a refurbished engine can work as well as almost as well as a brand new engine, and sometimes better if it's a better design. But the reality is that you still had metal that was decades old, and they don't know what caused the failure of the Antares last week, and so it would be speculative to say that it was the engine. I tend to believe it was the engine, and early comments from Orbital Sciences president indicate that they're already looking at a replacement engine for the Antares, and it'll probably be a solid fuel engine produced by ATK. Because I think they've had problems with that engine as early as 2011. I believe they had a failure and a ground failure of it where it exploded. And I think in May of this year, they also had a significant problem where the engine may have exploded in testing on the ground. Now, if that happens, then if those things happen, then it would be right in second guessing the company and saying, you know, well, why did you proceed with that? And there are all kind of factors. Some of it could be financial. Some of it could be that they're under contract to provide a mission to NASA and they don't want many delays. But look, these things happen not only in private industry, but it happens within NASA. NASA, with its two horrendous failures with the Challenger, Space Shuttle Challenger, and also the Space Shuttle Columbia, there was negligence, there was incompetence, and a lot of that had to do with bureaucracy, miscommunication, and some of it had to do with the fact that they were not receiving adequate funding for their program. So, again, I'm not trying to defend industry, but it works both ways.
Jason Ryan, what sorts of lessons is private enterprise taking from NASA's experiences?
If you asked me that same question a few years ago, I would say not very many. The attitude was, you know, we don't need NASA. We're not going to deal with NASA. They're old space. SpaceX will probably been at the very top of that pack. I wrote articles back in the day that were very critical of the attitudes and demeanors of quote unquote new space. And when I was interviewed and asked about this subject yesterday, they said, well, you kind of tamped down your criticism. And that's really not the case because my job as a journalist is to tell the story, whatever that story is. So the story is people are not willing to work with NASA, not go hand in hand with the agency that's launched over 160 crews to orbit. Then that in itself is a story. But I think that especially in the case of SpaceX, and I'm not as familiar with Orbital, but those attitudes and those demeanors are going away. When you have a conference with Elon Musk or Gwynne Shotwell, you will see they always give credit to NASA, Goddard, and so on and so forth, and they work hand in hand with them. And the biting criticism that they used to have of the space agency has faded. So for me in my job now, that's the story, is that it's no longer there. So I take it back to what I was asked yesterday. It's not that what I'm saying has gone down. It's that what they're doing has changed. So I think nowadays the relationship with Orbital and SpaceX and NASA is very good.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the future of space travel and the role of the private sector in the new phase of the space age. My guest this hour, Jason Ryan, editor and founder of the online space journal Space Flight Insider, and Marco Caceres. He's senior space analyst and director of space studies for the aerospace consulting firm Teal Group. And now let's bring a third voice into the conversation. Carolyn Porco is planetary scientist at the Space Science Institute and a veteran of space exploration. She was imaging scientist of the Voyager mission in the 1980s and the New Horizons mission now underway to Pluto and the Kuiper Belt. She's leader of the imaging science team on the Cassini mission to Saturn. She's served on countless NASA advisory committees, among other things. Carolyn, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. What do you hear in the conversation so far about new space innovation?
I think all of it is so it's expected. Everything that's happened, from the accidents to the criticisms and the analyses of the accidents, it's all to be expected. I could have told you. I could have written a primer on this before any of this happened. I think all the criticisms are premature. All you have to do is go back and look at the history of NASA, look at the history of its usage or its testing programs of rockets, famous rockets like the Saturn V, and you'll see that, and I'm just going to concentrate on Virgin Galactic, I don't think they're rushing at all. Remember that the launch of Apollo 8, which is the one that ultimately was the first to take people around the moon, I believe was, someone could check this, but it was a very early, maybe even the second time the Saturn V was launched with people on it. Now that, you want to talk about hubris? You want to talk about arrogance? Go back to the early NASA people. They were very ambitious. You want to talk about someone who maybe is talking, setting out a vision when he doesn't know what he's talking about? What about Kennedy's, President Kennedy saying, we're going to go to the moon? He wasn't a rocket engineer. So, you know, I think all of these criticisms are really overdone. Let's just back off and realize that in doing space exploration, you have to take the long view. And, you know, what now looks like hubris, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 years from now is going to look like just incredible vision. And we're going to be so grateful for what these people were willing to do right now.
So is NASA still doing the most interesting big projects to your mind, you know, Mars and Jupiter's moons and all the rest, or are these space innovators slowly closing in?
Well, they're doing different things. So let's remember NASA, one of your guests said this, NASA is right now, and really in the beginning, was in the business of exploration and technological demonstration. And of course, the beginning of NASA started with an arm wrestle with the Russians. But, you know, over the years, over the last 50 years, we have been in the business of scientific exploration. The space, I can never imagine a private company taking over and doing something like NASA, together with the European Space Agency, has done with the Cassini mission, which was an enormous exploratory expedition around the Saturn system. I mean, it took us, 7 years to develop the spacecraft and the instruments, 7 years to get to Saturn, et cetera. So, you know, I don't see commercial interest doing scientific exploration, but they will do everything. But, you know, one of your guests already said it, you know, NASA gets involved in the development of it because it's an organization that can marshal all the resources together and the finances together to do it. And then after it's, you know, kind of the path is laid, the development's done, it hands over the routine things like access to low Earth orbit to commercial interests. So I see that continuing. But I still really enjoy what's going on in the commercial sector and in the private sector, because, you know, it is important to give people a feeling of participation in space exploration. I know it's what Virgin Galactic is encouraging thrill seekers to get up into space and look at the Earth.
Yeah.
But, that's important. And they're also doing things in space which, from a technological point of view, when you push technology in space as opposed to on the ground, you are demanding levels of accuracy and precision that end up driving the technology. So to me, it's all good.
Let's get Mary in here, a caller from Winchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Mary. Thank you for waiting and welcome.
I'm probably going to make a few people upset with my comments. Or at
That's
least
okay. Bring it on, Mary. Go ahead.
I'm going to bring it on. Folks are going to disagree with me. Well, first of all, I have no interest in going up and looking at Earth from the moon or from any particular planet that's orbiting up there. And I feel like, you know, I heard the speaker earlier, Richard Brandon, I guess his name is, you know, talking about the greater cause and the purpose. And I guess what I would like to understand is what is the greater cause or the purpose for what my concern is bringing another, you know, wealthy elite group of people up to the moon or wherever they're going to go to look down on Earth when we're not dealing with any of our economic, environmental, or social issues on this planet. And then, you know, what wouldn't stop that group of people from building communities or building, you know, more corporations and doing the same thing to other planets? I mean, I don't have a sense of why there's any value. And given the current climate of what's happening with people in poverty and all the issues that you all know about and that Jane and Tom talk about on this show, I would like to understand better what the greater purpose or human cause is for doing this.
Mary, thank you very much. Carolyn Porco, speak to that. What is the greater cause, the greater purpose here? Isn't this just another elitist venture, to Mary's point?
Well, I think that, you know, just to listen to what Richard Branson has to say about where he's headed, right now, of course, it's very expensive because this is very early days, but I think his plan, his hope, where he's headed is that eventually it will become within reach, financial reach of more ordinary people. And I think, it's hard to quantify this, but I think it's true that whenever anyone has gone into space, talked to astronauts, Apollo and otherwise, and they've had a view of our Earth that no one else gets to see, and they see it as just a sphere in which we all live, no boundaries, it gives them a new view, it gives them a new perspective, and that perspective is valuable. Our explorations of the solar system have allowed us to look back at our Earth, and we see our Earth as it is, as we really are, and we need more of that in order to learn how to live together.
Marco, Jason, speak to this. Are we pouring a lot of money into another elitist venture, Marco Caceres?
I think that would be a fair statement if we were talking specifically about public funds. If we were talking about what's the greater good from NASA projects to go back to the moon or to even go to Mars, is it just a matter of, you know, going to Mars and planting the American flag again? That would be a legitimate argument to have. But this is a private venture. And public funds aren't going to be used for this. Well, at least they're not being used now. And so for me, Mr. Branson wants to create a new industry. If he wants to do it for the discovery of it, for the purpose of discovery, the challenge, then I say so be it. That's the way, you know, humanity has always worked. You know, we go for challenges and we learn. I mean, ultimately, if you want to talk about the greater good, it's learning, it's discovery.
Let's go to Kaylin in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Kaylin, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, I would almost encourage entrepreneurs and privately owned people who are willing to take the risk to do so, just because, you know, NASA does have funding, but it's somewhat limited, a penny on the dollar kind of thing. And, you know, the other ventures we have to really do scientific exploration and stuff up there is somewhat limited. So I would almost, like I said, encourage anyone willing to take that risk and who wants to spend the money there to do so.
You want to see more Elon Musk's, more Richard Branson's, more Jeff Bezos. Kellen, thank you very much. Here's Max in Miami, Florida. Max, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question pertains to, well, since you guys are on the topic of commercialization of space, I just wanted to comment on other aspects, too, like asteroid mining and the benefits that can serve all people of getting the same resources that are dwindling on Earth from asteroids, and also the legal ambiguities that some companies like Deep Space Industries and Planetary Resources are dealing with. And they're investing billions of dollars in projects to scope out asteroids, see what kind of minerals they have, and to mine these minerals and bring them back to Earth. My question is, why are they investing billions of dollars considering the international framework pertaining to the law and private appropriation of resources in outer space? I wonder if any of the commenters on your program have anything to say about that.
Max, thank you very much. Jason Ryan, was that you?
Yeah,
or Mark?
That's actually me. I have something to say both on what he said and what Mary said. I want to start off with, as long as there's been people on the face of this planet, there's been war, there's been disease, there's been social and economic hard times. That isn't going away, and I'm not going to focus on the tourist efforts that Sir Richard Branson is doing, because that's coming out of their pockets. It's not coming out of the taxpayers' money. What NASA does, and this is touching on Antares, is it? I want to say a few hundred thousand years ago, there was a few million people on this planet, and we were living under very horrid conditions. And over the years, our technology got better, and we got smarter, and now there's going on 7 billion people. That isn't going to change. The thing that is going to change is this planet is going to run out of resources, and we need to take these hard lessons that we learned last week and in 2003 and in 1986, and we need to continue to push forward. I believe your last speaker said something about mining an asteroid. Well, if one asteroid is worth several times the combined gross domestic product of the entire world, doesn't that make going there and getting the resources that we're running out of here on Earth all that much more valuable? I mean, I don't think that the general public has a good understanding of why space is the only issue that should matter in terms of long-term survivability of our species.
Carolyn, go ahead.
Jane, can I say something
here?
Sure. I've thought about this, and if I thought for a moment that drawing the NASA budget down to zero could significantly help the problems that we face around the world, I'd personally be in a terrible moral quandary. But I don't for a minute think that that's what would happen, because the problems are not basically fundamentally financial. There are problems of political will. There are problems of different national priorities, that is, different priorities placed by different nations. All sorts of other problems that are far more intractable than throwing money at it. So, and your last speaker just said this, it always seems, well, space is the one that's always held counter to our problems. NASA's budget is a tiny, tiny fraction of what the United States spends. It wouldn't solve a thing to make NASA go away.
Yep. Here's Lee in Panama City, Florida. Hi, Lee. Thank you for waiting and welcome.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I just want to say I spent 3 years in the my last 3 years in the military test and evaluation squadron, and I agree with you. We need a sheriff. We need a sheriff that's going to be a sheriff all the time, not just to begin with and then slack off. If you don't, then you're going to have problems. There's always going to be safety things happening like what happened to the last two.
A little more regulation, Lee. Thank you. Sarah is in Hudson, Massachusetts. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to you.
Hi. I just wanted to address that last caller who was sort of skeptical about the reasons for all this, just because I had heard Richard Branson talking, I think it was on a TED Talk, and he had mentioned that his greater goal is to make this our mode of transportation within our planet. Like taking a flight from New York to Sydney, Australia, you know, would only take like an hour or so if you could, you know, fly into space and fly back down. And I just thought that that was pretty cool, especially if it has like a lesser environmental impact, you know, as opposed to just regular, you know, flying on an airplane.
Other ways to use technology. Thank you very much, Sarah. Let's go to Fred now in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi, Fred. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I think that the private sector has a tendency to push the envelope a little bit too far, and I think some government oversight is necessary. For instance, if there's more government oversight on the Habitant Comet with those killer windows, we might not have lost as many people. And if we had more oversight on the approaches when we're dealing with a prop plane and a jet, that 707 might not have landed on that TWA over New York. So I think that government and military oversight should be increased, or else we're going to lose a lot of people that are able to spend and probably make a lot of money.
Fred, thank you. Carolyn, I was just going to ask you, Carolyn, should there be more regulation by the NTSB?
Well, here's one of my pet peeves, okay. Because, you know, as in all things in life, we want to seek moderation. And I think that if you just look at what's happened to NASA, government oversight has gotten so absurd that we almost can't turn around without going back to Congress and asking for permission. We have congressional members who are micromanaging NASA's programs, which has gotten to the level of absurdity. So not too much regulation. I believe in regulation. I don't want a Virgin Galactic spacecraft to come down on a major city. We have to make sure they know what they're doing. But I the pendulum is always in danger of swinging too far on this one.
Marco Caceres? I'm just curious, where do you think we're going? Where do you think we're going to be in 5 years from now as it relates to space exploration, space travel? Are we going to be sending people up for $250,000 a whack, or is this going to be just routine?
I think that the space tourism part of the commercial industry, space industry, is obviously going to be delayed by many years. We're not sending space tourists up on a spaceship, space plane 2 or 3 next year. We probably won't be sending them up in 2 or 3 years. But I think that the industry is here. I mean, we've begun. Every time you see test flights and you see people dying, I mean, that's part of the process. That's a bad thing, but it also can be a good thing in the sense of what we learn from it. And this is, again, what happened at the beginning of the aircraft industry, the automobile industry, the railroad industry. And so I think commercial space tourism is here to stay. And it may take longer than people like Mr. Branson wished, but it will happen.
Jason Ryan, how do you see it?
I see it like this. The folks that were up on Spaceship Two were test pilots. And I think the people that fly on Spaceship Two are going to be well aware, because from what I understand, they will have to go through a training regimen before they fly, are going to be well aware of the risks that are involved. This is not, as I said earlier, a risk-free endeavor. So they're going to have to understand that risk is a part of that, and I think that the public's going to accept that as well.
10 seconds. Carolyn Porco, you get the final word here.
Well, as I said, I think that, 5, 10 years from now, we're going to forget about this. There may be other accidents, but I really hope that Richard Branson, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, I hope they all push on.
Carolyn Porco, planetary scientist at the Space Science Institute. Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Marco Caceres, senior space analyst and director of space studies for the Thiel Group. Really appreciate your time, Marco. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
And Jason Ryan, editor and founder of the online space journal Space Flight Insider. Jason, thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thank you for your comments. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.